just like to hand over there to our panel chair, Emily, I'm sorry, I don't know your name, Cromer, who is going to chair this second panel of the day. Thanks.
Thank you very much for the introduction. Is the mic positioned accurately? Okay. Thank you very much. This next panel is going to really, if you weren't excited by the kind of the high-level multilateral framework for managing and controlling the transfer of nuclear items around the world, this panel is going to get you really, really excited. We will be talking about non-proliferation and nuclear export controls. We have a panel that will touch on both the high-level, again, regulatory and multilateral framework, as well as addressing some of the more practical issues that are faced by companies managing and, dare I say, facing the challenges of the export control regimes within which they work, which include both domestic export controls as well as extraterritorial export controls, which certainly present an added complexity for a number of companies in the world. We will hear first from Isabel Anste, who is going to speak on a gentleman's agreement, which enforcing multilateral nuclear export controls. Isabel is a doctoral candidate in the Department of War Studies at King's College London, looking at the negotiation of multilateral nuclear export controls, in particular the nuclear suppliers group, which drives a lot of the control lists that will be implemented by countries at a domestic level, with which companies will then need to manage kind of detailed, granular, specific processes and procedures to ensure that they are complying with these controls established by the Nuclear Suppliers Group. Isabel worked for 3 years at the Center for Science and Security Studies, where she worked on the production of the 2013 NPT briefing book for the British Foreign and Commonwealth Office, and she is currently a CSIS Pony Nuclear Scholar. So we'll start off with Isabel. And as was mentioned this morning, any questions will be off the record. If you have questions that are related specifically to the presentation, please do ask them after the presentation. But if you have a question that is more general, let's wait till the end so we can have a conversation and a dialogue about export controls generally. Thank you.
Hey, thank you very much for the lovely introduction. And I know it's always a tricky one straight after lunch, so I will try not to lull you into a food-induced sleep and keep you awake to hear a little bit about multilateral nuclear export control regimes. So I'm going to do a little bit of an introduction into the regimes, into non-proliferation as a goal, and then we're going to look at some of the obstacles at the multilateral level rather than looking at compliance at a domestic level, which we're going to address later in the panel. This will go on to the next one. So this is just an overview of what I'm going to look at. When we get down halfway through the presentation, I've picked out membership procedures, the rules slash guidelines, and we'll come on to what I mean by that, legitimacy, and a bit about implementation, and then some tentative conclusions. Who doesn't like me? There we go. So non-proliferation. In the international regime, how do you prevent the spread of nuclear weapons? Today we're really talking about horizontal proliferation, which is proliferation to new non-nuclear weapon state countries. I'd like us to mention that vertical proliferation is important as well, which is the improvement or extra acquisition of nuclear weapons by a pre-existing nuclear weapon state. But a lot of what we talk about when we talk about export control regimes is looking at states that currently don't have an established nuclear weapons capability, though we do include, of course, places like North Korea, which do have some capabilities, and we would like to prevent them from going any further. There are two broad approaches to non-proliferation policy, demand side and supply side. It's a fairly simple division, but basically, demand side is looking at how do you stop a country from wanting or needing nuclear weapons? So the kind of policies that includes are the nuclear umbrella, extended deterrence, security assurances, and perhaps in a more long-term way, reducing the utility of nuclear weapons on the international stage. I think it's fair to say that that's really what you have to address if you're looking at a long-term aim of nuclear zero, or even a long-term stability at what we have now. Because a determined proliferator with this kind of technology, you can't say that in 100 years' time wouldn't be able to, you know, make it itself. So demand side is the broad overview. Supply side is more short-term. But I would argue almost equally as important, because what supply side controls do, which is the physical prevention, we can't stop them from wanting it, but can we stop them from getting it? That's what buys time for those demand side, big, grand, diplomatic policies to actually have a chance to work. So export controls come in under the supply side non-proliferation goals. What we have at the multilateral level are a series of guidelines for what states should do. And we'll talk a bit more detail about what they are. But you have multilateral guidelines, and then you have national implementation, which is your export control legislation, it's your border control, it's domestic policy. And the obstacles, if you divide them into technical and political, the technical obstacles tend to be faced by states. They're how do you devise an export licensing system that allows companies to trade but doesn't allow them to trade in items you don't want them to? They're how do you identify who's making the products and how do you get the information out to them that these products can actually be used to proliferate? At the multilateral level, we're looking at some big political challenges. They may agree on several of the technical aspects, but it's getting the political consensus together that poses the real challenge, and that's what I'm going to be looking at in my talk. So I've divided them up into four broad areas. Membership. So there is no export control treaty. There's no huge international regime. There are a series of individual regimes. And these tend to look a bit like clubs. When we talk about the Nuclear Suppliers Group, it was originally known as the London Club. And I think we can immediately understand there's an issue of, well, who gets to be in the club? How do you get to be in the club? What happens if you're not in the club? I'm going to talk about procedures. Are they secret? This is obviously dealing with technical details that countries don't necessarily want to talk about with everyone. As soon as you start having secret meetings, you face political problems on the international stage. The rules themselves are... they're more like guidelines. They aren't rules. And we'll talk a little bit about Security Council Resolution 1540, which is a Security Council resolution and therefore is binding under law. But it faces its own obstacles. And it's aimed specifically at non-state actors. But everything else, all the other regimes, we'll talk about the Zanger Committee and the Nuclear Suppliers Group, they're just guidelines. They're understandings of what states' obligations are. They're not actually obligations. And there are no enforcement mechanisms. We'll talk about that in a bit more detail later on. And then legitimacy, which is an overarching issue that actually covers all three of these top ones. This is something that may be of less import once you get to a national level, but at an international level, it plays out in how these regimes interact with international law and how it affects international politics as a whole, with between big powers, the non-aligned movement, the NAM countries. Who's preventing who from getting what? We move on. So I'm a historian by training, so forgive me if I bore you with a little history. So my research has been looking at the history of these multilateral export controls, states getting together and agreeing that we will only export certain items under certain conditions. And I started out looking at the Quebec Agreement, and I won't bore you with too many details about what that was, but we're talking 1943, Manhattan Project, Britain getting back involved in the US's nuclear efforts. They come to this agreement to allow the British scientists back into the US. And part of that agreement stipulated that these two countries wouldn't share any of their nuclear knowledge or materials with any other country without consulting each other first. So here we've got this knowledge, we don't want to give it to anybody else. Second part of the deal was the Combined Development Trust, which said we're going to control uranium. We don't know if we can necessarily control the knowledge, but if nobody else can get uranium, nobody else, i.e. the Soviet Union, can make a bomb. fair to say they didn't understand how widely spread uranium was at the time. They genuinely thought that controlling the entire world's supply of uranium was a sensible policy. But the point is, they were still trying to control nuclear materials. They just didn't understand quite the scale of what they were hoping to do. Then you've got, over the course of the 1950s, this very nascent beginnings of nuclear trade, the first deals to sell nuclear reactors, and the IAEA, this idea after the Atoms for Peace speech that everyone should have access to nuclear energy for peaceful purposes, and the way to do that was to safeguard that material. At the same time that the IAEA is sorting out its safeguards regime, what's that going to involve, who's going to do it, the US tried to get a group of suppliers together. And they were called the Ottawa Group, and they met a few times in the early 1960s. The US trying to convince them not only to form a bloc in the IAEA on what safeguards should look like, but to harmonize their supply controls. And it went nowhere. And this was fairly fair to say the fault of France, who felt hugely left out after the US-UK nuclear effort. Because of that Quebec agreement to not share any knowledge, the UK, having been approached by France, had to say, no, sorry, we can't tell you anything. And the French were left rather to figure it out for themselves. So they were having nothing to do with UK-US-inspired initiatives to prevent the spread of nuclear technology. France was quite happy to sell its nuclear reactors and thought that was perfectly reasonable. Then in 1968, we've got the Non-Proliferation Treaty, comes into force in 1970. And here we've got the first introduction of export controls at a broader international level. And the important one for us today is Article 3, which hopefully I have quoted very boringly for you. This is what the Zanger Committee is looking at in particular. These are the two things that, if you're a member of the NPT, you're not supposed to supply to another country. So source or special fissionable material, or equipment or material especially designed or prepared for, and that's important, I should probably have italicized that for you, for the processing, use, or production of special fissionable material to any non-nuclear weapon state for peaceful purposes, unless the source or special fissionable material shall be subject to the safeguards required by this article. Immediately, there were problems in interpreting what a state's obligations actually were under this article. So, hopefully, let's carry on. I'll talk about that in a second. First of all, you have to define what they meant by the special fissionable material, and then you have to decide what they meant by the safeguards required by this article. And to this day, that's still can be a point of contention in reading about what this actually means. The reason I wanted to talk about IAEA safeguards is that immediately the question is, are these a condition of supply? So when you're deciding to export to a particular country, you have to have safeguards, but what type of safeguards? Now, depending on who you read, some will tell you they mean a comprehensive full-scope safeguards agreement with the IAEA, as NPT members are required to have in Article 3, Part 1. Others will say that only the special fissionable material that you're exporting requires to be under safeguards, and that was with the interpretation they've largely gone with since the 1970s. But Zanger clarify that that material has to be safeguarded, and the Nuclear Suppliers Group also use IAEA safeguards as a condition of supply. So it's the closest we get to a multilateral organization having anything to do with enforcement. The Zanger Committee offers understandings with no enforcement. The NSG offers guidelines with no enforcement. But the IAEA does play a role here because they are there to verify certain things which you can then export with some confidence. So it's the closest, really, we get, which is why safeguards are so important even when you're talking about export controls. You can't avoid the issue of talking about improving safeguards, different types of safeguards, i.e. full scope, the additional protocol. And there's an argument to be made that the IAEA has perhaps some greater legitimacy in its international role, perhaps, than the Nuclear Suppliers Group does, and even than Zanger does. It has a bit more broader acceptance. But even then, there's still no agreement about exactly what it's required to do. So the Zanger Committee was formed in the early 70s, just after the MPT came into force, to deal with these issues of what exactly would trigger these safeguards, hence the reason it's called a trigger list. If you export this particular item, it has to be safeguarded. And the Nuclear Suppliers Group followed fairly quickly on after for a couple of main reasons. I mean, there's the 1974 India test, but the reason the Nuclear Suppliers Group was considered necessary by the United States was that the Zanger understandings just didn't cover enough. They only covered parties to the NPT, which didn't include France yet again, so we've got France causing problems. And they didn't necessarily go far enough in what they covered. So the NSG was formed in 1974, 1975, and published through the IAEA, which was interesting, its trigger list and requirements for supply in the late 1970s. The other thing, as I say, we're going to have a quick look at is Security Council Resolution 1540, which criminalises spreading nuclear weapons technology to non-state actors. And we talked about it a bit earlier today in regards to nuclear security. So the first of the sort of obstacles that we face at a multilateral level is how do we get people involved? Who is the Nuclear Suppliers Group? Who gets to decide what gets exported and what doesn't? And you can see with almost everything except 1540, the Zanger Committee was 15 states. They were considered to be the main supplier states at the time, but they were an informal group. They decided that their decisions weren't legally binding. Even today, there's still accusations that they meet in secret. This is largely because a lot of what they do is attended by some confidentiality because they're dealing with issues that touch on national security. The Nuclear Suppliers Group has the problem to an even greater extent. It was 7 countries. They met in absolute secrecy. Secrecy was a condition of those early meetings, particularly from the Soviet Union and France, who were both the most important members of that group at the time, considering everybody else was from the West and interested in export controls, unlike France. And they added on another 8 countries in the 1970s, just as they published their guidelines. But from then on, in the 1980s, people just considered them to be a special nuclear cartel aiming to control the global nuclear industry. The idea that this was an altruistic organization attempting to keep the world safe didn't really cross anybody's mind. And this played out in a lot of the NPT review conferences, this constant accusation that there was this cartel at work making secret decisions about how nuclear technology was going to spread, was this keeping it from countries in the developing world, keeping a monopoly of nuclear power. And in the expansion in the 1990s, there's still a debate about whether the Nuclear Suppliers Group has the members it should have. A lot of people note that they're not all suppliers, though. To be fair, some of the ones that aren't suppliers are important transshipment states, and that's something else to consider when you're looking at your membership. If you look at just supplier states, how do you cover how this material is moving around the world? Again, Resolution 1540, a little bit different, combats some of the problems that these other two regimes have in terms of membership, should apply to all the UN states, but a lot of them, because it was a Security Council resolution made by only 15 countries, don't really consider it has much to do with them. Procedures are a problem, again, largely because they take place in secret. The Zanger's annual returns, which is good to have some intelligence sharing between the countries, but they're secret and confidential. The NSG we've already mentioned, in 1997, when they had one of their early outreach meetings, they constantly had to stand up and say, we don't have a secret blacklist of countries that we don't export to, because that was still considered to be the way that the NSG worked. In other terms of procedure, decisions are made by consensus, so the more countries you have in your block, the more difficult it's going to be to reach any kind of consensus. And the guidelines themselves are not legally binding. When we talk about export controls at a local level, and when we talk about them later on, we're going to talk about compliance and how important this is. At the international level, they're suggestions. In the Zanger Committee's case, they are understandings of our obligations. For the NSG, there are a series of guidelines as to how states agree to behave. They are quite literally a gentleman's agreement. This is how we're going to behave. But there's no external enforcement. The NSG doesn't have a record of whether or not it's effective, of whether its members do implement the guidelines they're supposed to. running out of time a little bit, but some things maybe to think about in questions are states are left to interpret these guidelines themselves. So Russia was able to sell to India on the grounds that it was a pre-existing deal and there were safety considerations. The US-India deal, there was an exception to the rules. So what does that say about how consistent your rules are? And even in 1540, they demand efficient and effective border controls, export licensing, no way of measuring what's efficient or effective. Also, no way of enforcing compliance or punishing those who don't comply. 30 seconds. Final point, really, is on the international level, what matters here is legitimacy. This filters down into every other obstacle, not just because states will comply with things that they see to be legitimate, but because if they're not seen as legitimate, it's the perfect get-out-of-jail-free card. If something isn't legitimate, you can easily say, I don't need to comply with it. It's not international law. It has no basis. It's a secret club. I'm not part of it. Improve legitimacy, and you have a chance, at least, of improving everything else as well. Implementation, as I say, happens at a national level, so I'm going to let my colleagues talk a little bit more about that. But there's no multilateral assessment of compliance, and there's no multilateral method of enforcement. That's all down onto individual states. And these were my very tentative conclusions, that at the multilateral level, political expediency trumps technical considerations. So you think you're concentrating very hard on the technical aspects of how to stop a state getting nuclear weapons, and you discover that at the political level, can't be done. There are two other many things going on. Perceived legitimacy, undermining regimes, giving states a way to avoid compliance, the level to which it's contingent on national measures, and if you have to enforce multilateral, you have to strengthen the legitimacy of the multilateral export control regimes. And I think that can be done through membership procedures and the guidelines. Thank you very much.
A great introduction to a bit more detail about the export control framework from a multilateral perspective. We're next going to hear from Daniel Salisbury, who's going to speak about the private sector and national controls. Daniel is a researcher for the British government-funded project on proliferation procurement and anti-proliferation in the private sector. The private sector and sites are really the front line for non-proliferation, so please welcome me and or join me in welcoming Daniel as we hear about engaging the private sector, the first line of defense against proliferation.
Thank you for that introduction. Good afternoon. Very pleased to be here. Thanks to the organizers for inviting me to speak. I won't introduce myself, I was going to, but you've already done that. But just to reiterate, Project Alpha, it's a UK government-sponsored effort to try and engage the private sector and to mitigate proliferation risks more holistically, I guess. We're based within the Centre for Science and Security Studies at King's College London. And I guess just as a disclaimer, I don't work for the British government. Sometimes people get a bit confused. I'll start by talking a little bit about the problem. Obviously, we've got Iranian and North Korean nuclear missile programs advancing with the help of illicit procurement. The past 12 months, they've been pretty busy. Just a few weeks ago, we had a third North Korean nuclear test in February. Also, the North Koreans have been very active in their rocket, space, or missile program, depending on how you look at it. We've had two tests in the past 12 months. This is a picture of some wreckage that they dug out of the sea of part of the second rocket test, I believe, and I'm sure there are some kind of Western goods in that somewhere. Iran as well, advancing steadily, maybe a little bit out of the news compared to North Korea recently, both on the centrifuge enrichment side and also on the missile side. Another issue to consider in terms of illicit procurement is the illicit procurement of military goods. The recent UN Security Council resolutions have sort of put an arms embargo on Iran and North Korea, and so both of them are trying to guard their ways to try and get hold of things that they can use in their military programs as well. Thinking more specifically what these developments mean for industry and national authorities, they pose a lot of specific challenges. Generally speaking, I think risk is quite difficult for industry to mitigate. Often goods are quite difficult to classify. The list that Isabel was talking about with the from the NSG, if you're a compliance officer in a business and you're presented with these and perhaps you don't have the technical background, it's quite difficult. Another problem here is that the goods that are used in these programs are not always controlled by these lists. They're not always listed. Due diligence isn't easy, and it's quite difficult to see sort of where to end your due diligence. And just generally, the risks are not obvious. It's not Iran sort of sending you an email and saying, we want to buy this, going through middlemen, transshipment routes, all these kind of things. On the other hand, government can't always get it right. They have a lot of resources, but at times of economic austerity, their resources are definitely limited. They have imperfect information. They can't see everything. They can see a lot more than industry can, but still not everything. And actually, it's not government that will go to prison when it goes wrong in industry, but they are sort of liable for the risk. So when a company comes to government and says, we want to export this, we're applying for a license, it's government that has to make that judgment call as to whether it's something that they can do. So that kind of summarizes the problem, hopefully. I'm now going to sort of present some conclusions from what we've been doing at King's and to how we can sort of go forward and try and mitigate these risks. Before I do so, though, I think it's really important to emphasize that compliance doesn't necessarily mean proliferation resistance. Compliance is very much a legal issue. You're either compliant with the law or you're not. And I think proliferation resistance or stopping goods from getting through to these kind of programs entails a much more holistic approach to the risk associated with illicit procurement. So from our research, and we've been doing research, but also going out and talking to industry and engaging them, we found that really a sort of a non-proliferation industry-focused engagement is needed to effectively mitigate the risks. But this kind of focused engagement will also sort of help to generally mitigate non-compliance risks across the board. So a little bit more about the project and what we've been doing. It was set up in the summer of 2011. It's UK government sponsored. We're there to sort of act as a facilitator. We've been focusing on, as I spoke about, proliferation resistance as opposed to compliance. We've been engaging companies on quite a number of different levels. We've been going and interviewing companies individually to sort of see how they do compliance, see what the problems are, see if they've had any suspicious inquiries and see how they could be sort of helped to do their job more efficiently. We've been to trade fairs, both sort of wandering around and talking to companies, and we've also had stands there. We've been using trade associations and already sort of established networks to build contacts. And through these, we've also been organizing a series of seminars, which I'll come back to later. In terms of the scope of what we've done, we've probably engaged over 300 companies on some level since we started. We've been focusing on a number of different industrial sectors and products. I'll come back to talk about what we believe are probably the sectors of concern or the ones that are targeted most by these kind of programs. And in doing this, we've really acknowledged the importance of engaging the big guys, the defense, nuclear, and aerospace firms. But I'll come back to talk about that too. In terms of levels of knowledge and good practice, I think it's really important to acknowledge that there is a great deal of knowledge and good practice out there in industry, and to start from that point. When thinking about where this lies within industry, it tends to be where companies have access to a lot of resources, so they have time and they have money to put into compliance. It's where the senior management are engaged in the process and see it as very important. And also it tends to be where the need for compliance is obvious. So if you're selling aircraft carriers, battleships, submarines, machine guns, it's pretty obvious that you need to control that stuff. We'll come back to look at some of the sectors where it's perhaps less obvious. And altogether, I think this good levels of knowledge and good practice are mostly exhibited in the large defense companies, in the nuclear sector, and in the aerospace industry as well. And part of that, I think, is because of the legal requirements of things like ITAR. So when we say that there's a lot of knowledge and good practice amongst the defense, nuclear, and aerospace companies, unfortunately, there's also a lot of good knowledge and practice where there's been a bad experience in the past. I'm going to go through a few examples here and sort of try and sketch out what proliferation procurement looks like in the 21st century. As these are kind of examples that we've got from companies, we've anonymized them, they've agreed that we can kind of do this. So example number one, I visited a carbon fiber firm, and they'd had an experience where a national authority came to them and said, look, your carbon fiber might have ended up in Iran. They never sort of say it did. It might have. So basically, they had an order from a distributor in Turkey. The order was made in good faith, and it was transshipped onto Iran, probably by road over the sort of 500-kilometer land border between the two countries. This company, it mostly surprised the automotive industries, so Formula One cars, that kind of thing. But in this case, the carbon fiber could well have been used in the nuclear program, in the centrifuges, or in the missile program, or just generally in military applications. Another example, a firm that produces electronic components, they sort of entered a discussion with the national authority. I think it also started when they had an instance of something being shipped on to Iran. And the national authority went through their order book and sort of looked down the list and said, okay, this, these different companies, we know that they've been up to no good. And it was actually the companies that they got orders from were based in 16 different countries. Some of them with quite strong export controls. UAE and Hong Kong, traditionally, we think of those as transshipment countries. But they also had orders originating in the US and Switzerland. And in this case, the orders, they came mostly from distributors or companies that claim to be distributors. And a lot of them, when questioned as to why they, say, we didn't have a website or something, they say, oh, we're just starting out. It's a new thing. So distributors often seem like quite a weak point in the system. A third case study, perhaps more relevant to the nuclear industry. I should add, the electronic components of use in missile guidance. So you're talking about the stuff that can withstand really high levels of acceleration, deacceleration, vibration, and shock. So this one, I think, is probably more relevant to the civil nuclear industry. A company in the UK that manufactures fuel control systems, they had a request from an unknown middleman for a type of a valve of use for use in a Chinese nuclear facility. And I don't work in the nuclear industry, but I was told that it's quite unusual to be approached by a middleman as opposed to the company that's constructing the facility. I'm sure you all know better than I do. So the company thought about this and said, well, this is unusual. They tried to verify it. They couldn't. They were dissatisfied with it and decided not to give it. Several months later, one of the senior guys in the company was on a site visit in China and was introduced to this mysterious middleman named Tiger, who explained, wow, we have your product in our facility. And the guy obviously couldn't go into the area, but it had ended up there somehow. How did it end up here? Well, it had been procured from a UK distributor who had sent it without obtaining an export license. And obviously the company was shocked. And this was almost something outside of their control because it was their distributor rather than themselves that had sent this. And one of the kind of crossover issues here, I think, is a safety issue. Thankfully, this valve wasn't used in a sort of a mission-critical point, but say if it had been obtained and had been put in a point and it was the wrong sort of specification of product, you could have serious safety issues on there. Anyway, I think all those case studies kind of reiterate that the main point of what we're trying to do here is to disseminate a sort of understanding of the risks and to sort of help companies to mitigate them before they have these kind of bad experiences. So having said where the good practices and knowledge and understanding is, can we try and sort of typify where the risks lie? And obviously we can't, it's not limited to this profile, but we can sort of put up some thoughts and factors as what feeds into this. Typical risk, probably a small firm, small and medium enterprise. Compliance is very burdensome for these type of organizations. It produces goods of concern. I'm not going to say that it's nuclear companies as such, but I think a lot of these companies factor into the nuclear industry supply chain in some way. there are not obvious risks associated with the goods. And here I'm thinking raw materials, components, this kind of thing. I already spoke about automotives. Another one of the carbon fiber firms that I know have been targeted, they make Chris Hoy's racing bike that he uses in the Olympics. There's other pictures there. On the left, industrial control systems in the brewery. You can use these kind of things to make things spin at a certain speed. And then on the right, the oil and gas industry, another one that uses kind of valves and things that can go into, say, centrifuge plants. They tend to have, say, one person or less working on compliance, or someone working on compliance in a part-time role. Also, what feeds into this is to the extent to which compliance sort of matters in their broader business plan. So if you've got a product range where you've got very few controlled goods, obviously you're going to focus less on the orders that relate to sort of controlled goods. Or, for example, if you only export very irregularly, you're not going to have a set system up to systematically address compliance issues. So what have we been doing to try and mitigate this? We've been sort of targeting the sectors which the Iranians target. We've been looking at carbon fiber, alloys, the civil nuclear supply chain, control systems, electronics, elements of the defense supply chain, valves, flow systems, technical consultancy, and machine tools. We've been doing these events on a sector-specific basis because there are certain elements that are specific to different industrial sectors. For example, carbon fiber, a big concern is a lot of the prepreg has to be transported in cold, packed with dry ice. And if that gets stuck at the border, then your whole order can kind of expire. So we're kind of trying to fill a gap in the market by looking at these dual-use sectors that are often kind of ignored. I think it's important that we try and leverage the supply chain. As I said, a lot of these firms supply into defense, nuclear, and aerospace companies. Is there a way we can leverage this? Can we ask the defense, nuclear, and aerospace companies to sort of reiterate the importance of mitigating these kind of risks? I mean, if your supplier is caught out, then it might reflect badly on you. Another way is to sort of get the defense, nuclear, and aerospace companies to assist smaller companies to mitigate risk. So, for example, if you're a large company and you're training 100,000 people, even the cleaner in basic export controls training, does it hurt to have a couple of extra people come in and benefit from that as well? And really, is there a tangible way to do this? And the main point here is that the reputational risk is kind of broader than the legal risk. That there are ways that you can end up on the front page of a newspaper without actually breaking the law. So the way we're taking this forward practically is through partnerships and dialogue. The concept is the company sort of signs up to become a partner. We're still developing this concept at King's, but we're sort of planning a rollout nationwide this year with UK government support. There are clear benefits for industry, helping them understand the risks. We can illustrate these using open sources where the government cannot. So, for example, the government provides an Iran list, but it doesn't name entities in other countries like the US does. It doesn't say which countries might pose a transshipment risk or diversion risk, this kind of thing. It's good for industry to demonstrate the commitment and to sort of understand the commitment of their business partners. And for government, it gives them a great understanding of where the risks are, and it can help them to sort of get to know industry and the capabilities that industry has. And I think all of this hopefully feeds into a broader sort of non-proliferation benefit where programs slow down and we have more time to be diplomatic and pursue other solutions. This is just a summary of the partnerships document. Quick plug, there's a pile of kind of handouts on the table at the back, blue in colour, so pick one of those up. It's quite basic stuff what we're asking companies to do, but it goes a little bit beyond the basics and compliance. So, for example, to share suspicious inquiries with government and amongst private sector competitors to sort of say, you need to look out for these kind of things when you get emails from certain people. Another thing that we're talking about is formalizing professional development. There's a lot of ways to build knowledge, and as I said, there's a lot of ways to... there's a lot of knowledge already out there. So a lot of the training solutions at the moment, they're quite compliance-based rather than this broader non-proliferation, mitigating the proliferation risk more broadly. So we've come up with a competency framework that hopefully tries to rationalise this and recognises both the achievement and what the knowledge is that's out there already amongst industry, but also provides a structure for professionals to train against. Why are industry interested? And we've had quite a good level of interest. Obviously, non-compliance risks, imprisonment, fines, reputational risks. But there's also a risk of being involved in proliferation. I mean, if your products end up on the front page of a newspaper, it just doesn't look good. And this can reflect financially. There are also great incentives. Obviously, corporate social responsibility is on the up. And linking to the theme of the conference, I think it provides both a safer nuclear future, and also it's linked to the future of the nuclear industry as a whole. So in summary, we've covered that legal compliance doesn't necessarily lead to non-proliferation, that the private sector and engagement of it is really important in this. We've tried to show that partnerships are the way forward on this, to use supply chain leverages to push these principles through. And we've spoken a little bit about some of the drivers and incentives, as well as some practical ways to take this forward. This is our website, it's on the handout, so get yourself one of those. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Daniel. That was very, very interesting. So to round out the perspective on export control, multilateral framework, national controls, teamed with a more practical application of how on earth do you make, how do you run a business and maintain compliance with export controls on a daily basis, we are privileged to have Neil Foreman, who is chairman of Centronic and the Nuclear Industry Association's exports groups, and he is going to speak to us on export controls from an industry perspective. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for that wonderful introduction. So here comes industry with a long list of what government can do for it. As I said earlier, when I was talking to the panel this morning, it's very difficult to say some of these things without coming over as it's a moan. So I want to avoid that. If I can. So I've been introduced, but I just introduced my two hats, as it were. One is Centronic, which you heard a bit about this morning. We supply radiation detectors to the nuclear industry. As a business, we're around about 60% nuclear. So we do have another 40%, which enables us to survive in the quiet times in nuclear, of which there are many. But we also, my other hat is, as a result of us being an export very much an export company. We do 50% of our businesses overseas. As a result of that, quite well versed in exporting, got involved in the export group for the NIA, and somehow a couple of years ago ended up chairing it. It's one of those things you're not quite sure how you get there, but it's actually a very, very useful position for me to be in from the business point of view as well. And I'll come on to that in a moment. But the export group actually started with, it was a DTI group that advised, the NIA joined to help advise where the mission should go. When the DTI started to run out of money a few years ago, it moved over to the NIA. I think the DTI, or BIS now, supply lunch and a conference room occasionally, and we pick up the bill for the rest of it. So that's kind of where we are with the group. But what it is an invitation to NIA members to come along and mix with people who are exporting. So people, particularly people who aren't exporting, they can come along and learn from some case studies, useful case studies, but also get the ECO community there as well so that they can exchange business cards, find telephone numbers, people to talk to. When things stall, they can sort of reach into the dark depths of the Foreign Office and ring somebody up and say, here's my export license number, what's happened to it? And they can have a dialogue, which is actually very important. That process in the last few years under the current government has moved along at quite a pace of opening the doors. It's come under the heading of the commercial diplomacy, which you probably remember was the largest delegation went off to India right at the start of the Cameron government. There was about 50 of them went. And the commercial diplomacy really has flown from there. And you've got a lot of people coming out into industry and saying, we want to engage with you, we're going to run these workshops. And it's really about industry taking advantage of that. So this is where we kind of deviate from the bit of what can government do for industry, because actually I'm a great believer in industry helping itself where it can, and engaging with the government and learning where it can and being as independent as possible. So Centronics supply the products to the nuclear industry, defence and aerospace as well, so we're quite well versed in the dual use side of our products. And I think the working groups of the NIA, they also do another thing which Claire mentioned this morning. There's a lot of conferences in the world today. It's a business in itself. As we all know, you can spend £1,000, £2,000 exhibiting at them. You can spend £6,000, £7,000. If you're a member of a trade association and they have a working group, why not go to it and mix with the people in the industry anyway? They're the same people you see at the conferences, to be honest. So, again, it's another good point about having an export group, actually mixing with those people. I make no apologies for having it London-centric as well, because, again, it's very difficult to get the ECO community out to Manchester, where everyone will tell you the nuclear industry is based. Reality is the nuclear industry is actually sort of spread around the country. Most of the people in the Northwest are focused on the Sellafield business, not really on the exporting. Those who really want to engage will come to London, spend half a day with us, and engage with the right people. I made some notes here prior to having the conversation this morning about it's a small business operating in a highly regulated international market, and it can be confusing, to say the least. Engaging with the ECO community helps get rid of that confusion. So you just, you know, we're not experts. I mean, this should come with a health warning. I'm not an expert in exporting. I'm not an expert in most of the information I've seen today is actually very, very interesting. It sort of backs up my working knowledge of the environment. I mean, I refer to the experts. I refer to the information available whenever possible. And part of the project that Daniel's engaged in there, we were one of the companies he came round to. He's also used the export group to publicise what he's doing. But I'm very keen to support anything that puts a website or any tools out there for companies to use. Basically, through all those tools, I think it's possible for you to become an intelligent supplier. I'm always trying to get my staff to understand that when they pick up the phone or answer an email, somebody wants to buy a product, they should have the basic knowledge of our product and whether it can be sold in that territory. If it can be sold in that territory, under what conditions? So 9 times out of 10, you will have somebody ringing up because they've seen the product. We're one of only a few people in the world who do what we do. They want to buy it from us. We should be able to tell them what the likelihood is that we can sell it to them. And we should also be able to tell them how long it will take. Now, some of that does depend on the ECO community sticking to their charter, so it moves out of our control. So we do sometimes run the risk of egg on our face in industry, because it does sometimes go very, very quiet, and we can't get an answer. However, if you have those telephone numbers, if you have those contacts, if you've made that effort, if you're working in the export world, make the effort, get involved. Then you can actually speak to the people, you can speak to your customer, and you can keep him informed along the way. Always best to start off by saying it's going to take a long time. So, we touched on it this morning. As a supplier in export, particularly in nuclear, also in defence, any dual-use products, you will have the privilege of being audited by a number of different agencies in the UK, usually invoiced for the privilege as well. It is a cost that we have to bear in the UK, but it does safeguard our reputation. I mean, Daniel just touched on it there. Last thing I want to see is my company in the news for the wrong reasons. And we do see one or two, don't we? In the case recently of somebody who was exporting batteries to Iran via Holland, I think, and ended up in the US. I don't want to go there, and I don't want my company to go there either. It's not worth risking the rest of the business for one small contract, or even one big contract. You look at the whole business, you look at the reputation. This company's been working since 1945. Why would I risk it for one contract? It's just not worth it. And at the same time, if I think I'm going to risk it, I can usually ask somebody to make sure I'm not going to. I'd like to just touch on a case study. I was trying to find an interesting anecdote just to give you a sort of description of sometimes the problems that we face. And one of the ones was India, I think was mentioned in both presentations, actually. India is interesting because George Bush went there, I think it was 2007, came back, he announced that there was going to be an exchange of nuclear technology. To the Indians, that meant it was on. Everything was on, they could buy everything from us. The phones didn't stop ringing, the emails started going. All of a sudden, we had this problem of actually just pushing back quietly, saying, no, actually, we can't supply to you, and trying to demonstrate to them it wasn't us saying no, but it was actually the government that was saying no. That's quite difficult at times, because it does get a bit personal. There were some outward missions. There was a mission led by Mandelson that went out there in 08, I think it was. I was part of that mission. It was all moving in parallel with the dialogue going on with the Indians. What actually happened was the NSG, for those of you that don't know, I'm sure a lot of you do, basically they didn't join the nuclear suppliers group, but some of the sites there for the civil nuclear, they said they'd separate the weapons program from the civil program, put the civil sites under IEA safeguards, and therefore those sites would conform to international norms, i.e. be a normal export procedure. So we moved into that arena very, very slowly, and it's moved to the point now where the Indians are still blaming us for not being able to supply. I've had a license held up for about 2 years, I think, and the clue's in the title, it's a fishing chamber. So you can understand the difficulty of supplying something that call a fishing chamber to a nuclear reactor. They basically have engaged when they wanted to engage, and they've stood back and just slowed the process down when they've wanted to as well. Nonetheless, the Indian nation, all the people that we deal with, think it's the UK government. So we're having to sort of balance that, and we end up being a bit of a representative for the UK government, just trying to balance that that sort of body of opinion that comes out and move the licensing process forward. But what I do, I've got contacts in Delhi, in the FCO and in UKTI. I've got contacts in London. And what I do is I make sure that I nudge them for updates on a regular basis, and then I update my Indian intermediary. So we will get there. I think the last time I was told, I had a good email from in the beginning of, no, 25th of November, I think it was, saying, nearly there, lawyers have agreed the text, we're just waiting for that to go through. When Cameron went out there about a month ago, I thought he was going to use that one as one of his, you know, something to announce. He didn't, so I'm hoping that the next time there's a VVIP visit, then we will finally get to the stage where somebody can announce that the Indian government have signed off on the government-to-government assurances, which is the very, very last piece of the whole process. So in conclusion, I think my recommendation to anyone in industry would always be to engage with the community. Engage first, understand what it is you're trying to deal with. Don't just try and sell to somebody because they want it. Find out if you can sell, how to sell. There's plenty of tools out there. I think the other thing is you've got to really know the territory. Because you're going to be asked questions by your customer, but you're also going to be asked questions, again, as the previous two presentations said, by the UK government. They don't have all the answers. They're going to ask you, what is your opinion? Very last thing is, there is a piece of small print in the documentation, and it says, you must satisfy yourself that the product won't be subject to diversion. And that's key to this. It doesn't matter how much work you do filling in forms, processing things, waiting for answers to come back from the ECO. You have a responsibility as a supplier to make sure that you've done everything you can to ensure it won't be subject to diversion, because you are the one who understands that market. I think that's very important. So that's my view of the market as it is.
Thank you very much, Neil. And I'd just like to make a few comments before we open the floor up for questions and answers. I'd like to emphasize the fact that export controls affect every single company. They don't just affect weapons or uranium. Export controls control carbon fibers. They control radiation-hardened microelectronics. They control microelectronics that extend past an ambient temperature range. They control oscilloscopes. There are very, very, what you would probably consider benign items that are controlled because they may have a dual-use purpose, meaning a commercial company may manufacture them, a commercial company may develop them. However, if they end up in the wrong hands, they can be used for a far more nefarious purpose. I wanted to an anecdote about this fact, the fact that not just the really, really the crown jewels of your technologies, but also a lot of the components and the critical parts that may not be as expensive or technologically advanced also have quite an impact. And when you're exporting them or purchasing them from suppliers, they also merit a great deal of care. There was a quite a famous American case where a gentleman named Asher Khani purchased medical devices. They were medical triggered spark gaps. The end use allegedly was for a hospital in South Africa. However, they were actually destined for the Pakistani nuclear program. So to highlight, you know, Neil's point about diversion, it's quite important that you know your customer. It's also quite important that you understand those items in your supply chain and those items that you have in stock that, though they may not be the crown jewels, still are a critical component to either a weapon system or a missile program. So I think the export controls, while they may not be as impactful as the security discussion that we had this morning, they certainly do affect you on a day-to-day basis, and they also have a risk of occurring on a more regular basis. And when they do go wrong, despite the fact that you might have had an unintentional sale to a distributor that diverted them to a nuclear program or to a missile program or to a Chinese ballistic missile program, you're still going to have to deal with the fallout. So it's worth investing the time in knowing your customer and training your team to recognize red flags. Red flags being the fact that maybe you get an order or a query from someone with a Yahoo email address when normally you only sell to businesses. Or, as you mentioned, Neil, selling to a business that really has no tie to the industry that you're in. My former role, I was managing an export control compliance program for a company that made radiation-hardened microelectronics. One day we had an order from a dairy breeding farm. They really have absolutely no reason to purchase that kind of technology. And it was a bogus diversion type query. But it happens, and it happens a lot. And if you talk to anyone in industry who is either forward facing, deals with a distributor network, or is in the compliance function, they will tell you that they get bogus queries, there is a lot of diversion out there, and it happens. So with that statement, I will open up the floor to questions. Hugh.
Hi there, yeah. Hugh Chalmers at RUSI and also UK Pony. I'm just going to abuse my role as a roving microphone for a second to get in a question, mainly for Isabel and for Dan, but also, I guess, in a lesser extent for Neil, which is really trying to pull out the futures side of this nuclear futures conference. Because it was interesting, Dan, that you used the example of the Unia 3 rocket and Iran to demonstrate the problems of export control. And in the recent analysis of the Unia 3 rocket, it turns out that actually quite a large number of the components in it were indigenously manufactured, while some of the more complex parts, things like the turbo pumps, which were beyond the capabilities of North Korea to manufacture, were imported. Large amounts of it was indigenous. And the same is happening in Iran as well, in that they're being forced into developing a domestic production capability. And looking kind of far into the future, do you feel that essentially nuclear export control faces a really uphill battle, because essentially it rests on somebody wanting something but not being able to produce it themselves? It needs there to be an imbalance there. And if, as technology develops, more and more people become capable of producing these capacitors, these chips, whatever, is nuclear export control going to just not be able to keep up? Will it eventually come to the point where essentially it's useless? I mean, an example would be, you know, the development of bacterial resistance. You can only fight for so long before essentially the tide of technological development overtakes. So whilst I know that Neil wouldn't really want to consider that situation where all of a sudden he's battling about 50 competitors rather than only a few, I would be interested to know the panel's thoughts on the future sustainability of nuclear export control.
Perhaps while you gather your thoughts on that, Dan, I can say that has happened in India and other embargoed areas. There are reverse engineered products that look very familiar to me, and I like to think are not as reliable as ours, but when they are controlling nuclear reactors, in some ways I also hope I'm wrong. So,
thanks, Hugh. Very, very good question. I guess to sort of defend myself here, I never sort of said that they'd solve everything. It's more that we can just slow things down and give time for diplomacy to work. Another thing that might be even a little bit further in the future, but to think about, is things like 3D printing. I mean, when that gets bigger, you can control printers that print printers. I mean, it becomes very complex. That's, I guess, why we're taking quite a small, a narrow focus and looking at the industrial sectors that really matter, the things we describe as choke point technologies, and these are the ones that are most difficult to master. One example here is carbon fiber. The Iranians, they announced, I think, last year that they put together a carbon fiber production line and that it was all working fine. And this really emphasizes the need to engage industry on this, because there are, I think, only four or five really top technical consultancies in the world that work with carbon fiber and work to sort of pass on knowledge on carbon fiber production lines. Obviously, they don't do business with Iran, but we can go to them and we can get them to sort of look at the video footage that was out by Press TV, the Iranian state news thing, and to get them to sort of say, what do you think about this? What does this look like? Is it going anywhere? We've been doing some quite detailed technical analysis on carbon fiber and looking at sort of the various strengths and what you can use in centrifuge programs. And from that, you can kind of look at company websites in various places and see what their capacities are. And you can get a good idea of kind of what's where. So I think this is a real important reason to engage industry, is that they have this knowledge and this tacit knowledge. Another thing to think about here is intangibles. So if you can't control the technology, you can kind of slow the spread of the technology by sort of limiting access to the knowledge. This is both the knowledge that you can write down and then the tacit knowledge that you can only really pass on by doing. And I think there are some real issues here, because the controls in the intangible area are sort of increasing. The guidance relating to them is increasing in scope, and sort of companies are becoming more aware of this. But I think when you look at the number of, if you were to look at the number of licenses applied for intangible transfers compared to the number of licenses applied for actual tangible technology transfers, you'd be quite shocked that there's probably very few applications at all. So there are just some thoughts.
And I'll add one comment as well. When you do have export controls that limit exports to a place like India or China or Iran, and then you have a domestic development, there's also an economic impact upon your supply chain. So what you don't want to happen, and I think that this is really another case for engaging regularly with the regulators, is you don't want to create a competitor in a market where you can't sell into. So both what you can theoretically have a situation where you have a country that previously didn't have the intrinsic capability to develop the item, and then they also are going to sell it potentially to other areas and countries to which you could not, because the country that they're functioning in isn't a part of these multilateral regimes. And they start taking business away from people like Neil, which undermines this country's supply chain. So there's an economic impact and a supply chain security issue as well, relating to your question, Hugh. It can certainly backfire.
I don't have a huge amount to add, but just from the multilateral prospect isn't ideal. It's a very fragmented and overlapping system, and I think, as we've heard in other areas, it doesn't yet cover what could be the implications of a nuclear renaissance. And there's quite a lot of work going on in terms of policy prescription of what can be done better. And I think there was a lot of hope that UN Security Council 1540, because it was part of the UN, because it had a legal framework behind it, could bring in other countries. It includes a specific requirement to help countries that aren't capable of having export controls. But how the multilateral export control regime can face indigenous production, and I mean, there haven't been any truly indigenous nuclear weapons programs to date. Even the US is not a US program. It relied heavily on scientific knowledge from other countries. But it certainly is not a prospect you can rule out. I wouldn't, given the complexities, it's something that we can delay, I would say, for quite a long time. But I think that from a multilateral level, if we're facing a nuclear renaissance, a lot will have to be done if the export control industry is to be able, mechanism is to continue to be even as effective as it isn't today, and it probably needs to be more effective.
Thank you. Bill Nuttall, the Open University. This is a historical question for Isabel about the very early days of the nuclear supplier group. You mentioned France in passing, but my question is about the Soviet Union. I mean, and you mentioned the distinction between horizontal and vertical proliferation and how the focus was on preventing horizontal proliferation. But I'd be curious if you could say a little bit more about how the West dealt with the conversations with what was, in fact, the great enemy of the era in the early 1970s.
Quite interesting was the degree to which the Soviet Union turned around its opinion on safeguards and export controls. And it was the fundamental reason why the non-proliferation treaty was signed. It was a discovery on the behalf of the Soviet Union that horizontal proliferation didn't really help them either. That was the big sort of strategic discovery, was that they didn't want other nuclear powers around either. And they'd done a lot of trade. I mean, when the US and Canada traded their early reactors, they did at least include a commitment to peaceful use. It wasn't particularly verifiable, and we saw in India's case, it led on to India's explosion in 74 using Canadian-supplied technology and US-supplied heavy water. But the Soviet Union had conducted deals within its own sphere of influence that it didn't even include a commitment to peaceful use. So you see a complete strategic shift in the late 1960s on behalf of the Soviet Union that made the non-proliferation treaty possible, and it made this nuclear suppliers group possible, because unlike that Ottawa group that they tried, which the Soviet Union was not involved in, those were Western suppliers, by the early 70s, the Soviet Union saw India testing a nuclear bomb and thought they'd quite like to stop the spread of this technology as well, and it gave them that common ground. And they are interestingly enthusiastic within the conversations. It's all trying to get France on side. France is the difficult partner of those original seven. The Soviet Union wants these export controls. It wants to make sure it's not going to have a different system from the US. It's France saying, well, actually, we'd quite like to sell to India, and we might not include export controls. And Britain thinking desperately, well, if France doesn't include controls like safeguards as a condition of supply, then we can't either. And the infighting that goes on between industry saying, if France breaks, we break too, and the government and Foreign Office saying, we can't, even if France breaks, even if France doesn't include conditions of supply like IAEA safeguards, we have to, are really, really very interesting. It's not the Soviet Union that posed a problem. It was France, I'm afraid to say.
Thanks. Two-parter, if I might. We've been talking about bits of hardware, you know, boxes that do things and components that go in boxes that do things. But what about the more intangible things? What about software? That's sort of part A. I mean, are we worried about that, and what's the UK's position on dealing with it? And the second one is people. Because British universities traditionally have trained an awful lot of people in the nuclear arena. It wasn't all that long ago that master's courses in nuclear engineering were 50% Iranian students. And that's not true anymore, but there are still some. So how sensitive should we be about encouraging into our universities bright young things from, we could list a whole bunch of countries, who we're going to train up and send back, perhaps with things that they've begged, borrowed, or stolen from around the departments they've worked in and the contacts they've made while they were in the country, but also simply with the ideas that we've hopefully trained them with.
Let Dan take a little bit on the software side. I know nothing about, one of the comment I would make is that certainly in supporting what you say on the bright young things front, whenever we organise trade missions, we always try and ensure that
we have an educational component to that trade mission, because it tends to be one of the most interesting things for any of the countries, particularly India. And they're actually continuing a relationship. I think Iran, whilst I'm not a student of the politics, I think there was probably a period where we sought to engage rather than distance ourselves from the problem in order to manage it. But certainly education from the UK still has a very good reputation. But they are finding it more difficult now to fill those places with foreign students due to the restrictions on visa applications. And they are groaning under that, because they are finding it difficult to actually continue supporting the courses without that foreign component. So.
And I'll just add a bit of kind of conflict, or I guess comparative law, if you will. The generally, if information is in the public domain, or if it is university or basic research, it will not be controlled from an export controls perspective. The UK does not adhere to an idea that someone who is of a different nationality should require an export control license to receive information when they are within the borders of the UK. So this is actually in contrast to the American perspective, which will actually require countries and even universities to vet the nationality of their students, which is quite controversial and is quite an awkward position, especially for American data coming to the UK or to Europe, for which this same standard will apply because it is American origin technical data. So there could be a situation where if a UK university is teaming with an American university or an American company, you might have restrictions based on the ITAR or the AR because you have a student that was either born in a country other than the UK or holds even a dual passport holder can trigger some type of licensing requirement. This actually is not a UK requirement, although it might impact UK businesses and universities when they're teaming with on a US-based program.
Got a question about for Dan about the engagement project. It's one of those ideas that sounds so simple and brilliant. You think, why weren't we doing this before? So I'm just, the question is, whose idea was it? Where did it come from? And is this a general trend of trying to engage with industry more proactively so that we can help share knowledge and information? And is there a plan to extend it beyond the borders of the UK and, you know, try and use these techniques to look at the kind of global industry?
I think it is a kind of a general trend that came along. So we've spoken about 1540, the UN resolution in 2004, which was kind of response to the Calm network, but also other things like nuclear terrorism fears and 9/11, etc. And that did contain a kind of a reference to working with the private sector. When I say private sector, I'm sort of talking more broadly beyond exporters or manufacturers, but also to include transportation industry, finance industry, insurance industry, because all of these can kind of help to enable WMD proliferation as well. This has also been reflected in the UN panels of experts. I don't know if everyone's familiar with the UN panels, but when there's a sanctions resolution imposed, a panel of experts is set up. It usually includes people, one person from each of the P5 and several others, and they travel the world and they sort of see how sanctions are being adhered to by different states around the world. If there's a case where a boat full of aluminium tubes has been interdicted somewhere, they'll go and inspect the cargo and then write up a report. And the UN panels have been quite keen on this idea of engaging the private sector as well. In terms of overseas efforts, I mean, it is quite an attractive idea, because at a time of economic austerity, it does sort of help the governments or national authorities to do their job. It's almost a force multiplier if you can set aside a small group of people to engage the private sector and get them to almost self-regulate, then that's helpful, right? Japan have been doing this for quite a while. There was a famous incident in the 80s where some Japanese machine tools Toshiba were sent to the Soviet Union along with some computer numerical control systems from Norway, and they were meant to be going to a civil facility to make ship propellers. They were diverted to a dockyard to make submarine propellers, and of course the propellers on a submarine is what keeps it relatively quiet and difficult to detect. The US Navy sort of, they estimated the damage to be in the billions of dollars, and there were congressmen smashing up Toshiba radios with baseball bats outside of Congress. Obviously, it didn't look too good. The response to this in Japan, where kind of corporate culture is very important, was to set up this organization that's called SysTech. They're quite a big organization, a staff of about 40 and a turnover of about 6 million, I think. But the staff are taken from METI, which is their licensing authority, and from think tanks, Ministry of Defense and Academia, to advise the private sector. If you were to sort of think about how something like that might fit into the UK, Japan is obviously bigger, but doesn't export any defense products because of their sort of principles on defense exports. So something in the UK could perhaps be similar in scope. Other countries have also done similar things. There's one in Korea that's doing something similar. And within Europe, BAFA in Germany are quite big on this, and they've been doing a lot of outreach work in places like China. So it is kind of climbing up the radar. You don't see it so much in the US, though, because there's a lot more of a kind of confrontational thing there. So the US authorities tend to sort of shoot first and ask questions later. And obviously, this isn't so conducive to sharing information when it comes to getting suspicious emails and things. So, yeah, so it's climbing up there, I think.
Claire Durkin, URS. I think I would quite like to put the panel on future mode, but also on alert mode. It does seem to me that we've been talking about a system that was set up to look after people selling big fat guns to regimes we didn't like. It was a jolly good setup. And it was a good regime. We have been adapting and hoping to catch up ever since with the more sophisticated regimes. And we've got our dual use, and we're worried about that. And we're now looking at intangibles as well as tangibles. I am reminded of trying to worry about the digital industry when everybody was running out of money with music, and we were all worried about what on earth do we do with copyright now. And we've been pulling our hair out, and we have been following rather than leading, right along. Now, it's bad enough if you happen to run HMV and you go bust. That's unfortunate. It's a heck of a lot more unfortunate if we get it wrong in this area. And rather than just adapt and modify and get groups together, should you not be tearing up what we've got for this and thinking fundamentally differently? And we've heard a lot today about 1540. To me, that sounds like a date. 1540 sounds remarkably like some time around the Treaty of Westphalia, where we were setting up city-states. And the city-states were dead good in their time. And it's quite useful when we're exporting one city-state to another. But we are global, we are talking intangibles, we are talking students, and we are talking know-how. And actually, I wish that the Russians had used the Toshiba Westinghouse technology when they were building their nuclear civil plants. So sometimes proliferation could be a good thing. So I want you to think more fundamental and more serious about what we really do. Should we look behavioural? How do we cope in the future?
I'm happy to get started on this one. That is the perfect question for this very point in history, because so many of the export control regimes, both at a multilateral level and at a national level, were constructed really with a Cold War mentality, talking about tanks, talking about guns, and talking about state actors. And I think that one of the key elements of risk moving forward is moving from looking at export controls from a state perspective to looking at the risk of non-state actors. Because a lot of diversion and a lot of the enforcement cases and a lot of the cases or incidents that you hear about just through the grapevine don't involve necessarily the Iranian government or the Chinese government. They involve people who are trying to make money, as well as those who have truly nefarious intentions. Because these controls exist, there is a lot of profit to be made if you're willing to sell controlled items to someone who is faceless. And so what it does is it creates a real burden and imperative upon universities, industries, suppliers, everyone in this community to know their customer, know who you're dealing with, and to understand the implications and the climate in which we live, because governments are moving very slowly. Controls come and go years, decades after an actual need exists. Cloud computing, we're talking about software, but software was 10 years ago. What do you do with a cloud? Where is a cloud stored? Where is your potential, is it stored in Germany? Is it South Korea? Might it be China? You don't know. And so that is the perfect question. In addition to non-state actors, I would also say the digital age is going to be one of the most important factors to export controls. We had the comment this morning about IT and cyber terrorism or cyber attacks. It's not just terrorists, it's bored teenagers that can suddenly expose your network of either nuclear technology, military technology, ballistic weapons or missile delivery systems, in just because they're bored on a Saturday afternoon. So it's quite important that you keep all of these in mind. Two things that are going on in the policy world right now. I don't want to get obviously I'm American, so please indulge me just a moment. The American system is going through a huge export control reform effort right now. The tagline is higher fences around smaller pastures, trying to put the right level of control to the right item rather than controlling every nut and bolt that ever is going to go into a nuclear reactor or a military submarine or a missile or a tank, trying to identify those that are truly strategic and critical, and allowing companies to focus their resources and their time and their training on the items that actually matter. Is it actually going to happen? I think it is. Is it going to be as impactful as everyone hopes? Probably not, because it's policy, but it will help. On the flip side of that is the Arms Trade Treaty, which negotiations will be are ongoing. There's another round in New York, I believe it's next week, looking at establishing at the UN level requirement or export controls for traditional armaments, which at this point seems perhaps a bit outdated. But it is another evolution that is currently going on in today's climate.
So. To pick up from a historical point of view, what you said about it being reactive is actually increasingly becoming the theme of my research. Everything the NSG ever did was in response to something. It was a bolting the door after the horse had already fled. The reason... the argument runs that the NSG was successful in coming up with its lists in the 1970s, where that Ottawa group achieved nothing in the 1960s, was the 1974 India test. So they were behind the game. India had the technology. If you wanted to stop that from happening, you needed to stop America and Canada selling to it in the 50s. They responded to that with a system of controls. They then didn't update them or look at them or meet again throughout the 1980s. And then they discovered what Iraq had managed to do, largely legally, through dual-use components. And they meet again in the 1990s to prevent Iraq from happening. Well, they're 4 or 5 years too late for that at that stage. 1540 came out of, Dan mentioned, the AQ Khan network, so illicit procurement, so attempting to find a way to stop selling to non-state actors. But again, it came out of what they'd managed to sell to Libya, to Syria, to Iran. So from a historical point of view, they keep trying to do this and to get one step ahead, and it hasn't worked so far. So if somebody can come up with a way for them to get one step ahead, that's what has to happen, but it hasn't happened so far.
I just caveat this all by saying I'm no expert on intangibles at all or software. But I think there's definitely that we're seeing a lot of shifts occurring. There's a lot more focus on other industries now. Say the recent Security Council resolution, there's a lot of focus on sort of finance, insurance, transportation. But where we've got a relatively well-developed, and I mean this is almost the same as intangibles, you've got a relatively well-developed set of guidelines and thing and to help companies to stop the export of tangible goods. You've got even less well-developed guidelines when concerning finance. I know the Financial Action Task Force has been doing a lot in that respect, but probably not enough. There's nothing on insurance really at all. So you've got these industries really not knowing what they're doing when it comes to these kind of things and just having to make do. Personally, and this is my personal view, did I emphasize it's my personal view, I think we should focus on the hard cases of proliferation in the states that matter. We should focus on the Irans and the North Korea. India is a massive compliance issue, but it's also a massive market, and we shouldn't forget that. When we're doing our outreach, we try to emphasize what it's possible for industry to do rather than what they shouldn't do, because that's kind of more important. And in this regard, we're trying to sort of help outline how much time it would take to get a certain type of a license for certain types of goods to safeguarded or non-safeguarded facilities to allow for firms to approach this. I think generally, in terms of a sort of a, if you're looking for what I think is a revolutionary shift in this area, I'll put myself out there. I think okay, at the moment in the UK, you've got the ECO. Part of the Business Innovation and Skills Department, they administer the licensing process, they farm out applications to different government departments. I think it's staffed by about 40 to 60 people. And I remember the director of the ECO saying last year when they were dealing with the Libya case, it was a year of guns, drugs and money. Guns being, first of all, dealing with the Arab Spring export licenses to various regimes there. Drugs being the export of some kind of drug that's used in lethal injections to the US, and money stopping money going to the Gaddafi regime. So they've got a lot on their plate for 40 to 60 people. So I think a move to something that's kind of self-sustaining is good. A move to sort of further self-regulation by industry is good. But at the same time, you've got to really try and minimize the burden to industry of doing this. I mean, we always say that the worst case scenario is when you've got a company that's trying to implement compliance. It's using non-best practice to do so. So it's incurring the cost of compliance, and it's also still at risk of being found non-compliant. And I think the way forward here is to try and sort of cut up these areas into bite-sized chunks to make the information digestible so that smaller firms, when they've got one person working on it part-time or whatever, they've got the guidance material there. And it's kind of easy to use, the controls are easy to understand, and that makes their job easier. And I think we should try and include and sort of branch out guidance in this area to include sort of more guidance on intangibles, more guidance on software, although GCHQ does quite a good job. And also to sort of look at other industries, the finance industry, the insurance industry, and transportation industry, and just sort of try and help industry to self-regulate.
We are nearing the end of our time, and I just have one quick and final question for the panelists, and that would be, given the fact that we've heard that Iran was has domestic capability, that they have, through legal means, been able to get to where they are through purchasing dual-use products, and through hearing that there's potentially some competition for some of our important suppliers, based on the fact that they are unable to sell into these markets, I would just like to hear from you, is this export control regime a good or a bad thing? Is the world a better place because of it? Is it safer? Does it work? Or is it creating competition in markets that aren't part of these multilateral regimes? Or is it just simply ineffective?
My point of view, what I see is, I mean, in any given situation, if you stop somebody doing something, there's going to be a reaction. That reaction, by and large, if you disengage from a community, is going to be uncontrolled. You will obviously get some people sort of sprouting up as well who will seek to make money out of that situation as well. They should be in the margins. The red flag should come up. We've had people say, can you ship through Singapore in kit form with instructions? It's a red flag. There are those kind of things come up. But we've equally had requests come from embassies which were rather strange. There were powers that perhaps should have been on the same playing field as us. It is one of those things that I think you're quite right. The UK export community will always play it exactly by the letter of the international agreements. And it doesn't matter what other countries are doing. And I guess you've got to draw your line in the sand, but it does mean that there are a lot of uncontrolled things going on. And I sometimes wonder, and I used the example earlier of the Indian reverse engineering of the product, I sometimes wonder if a positive engagement in certain areas, and in a way keeping your enemies close and understanding what they're doing, might be a better way forward. How easy that is to do in diplomatic channels, I wouldn't like to hazard a guess.
At the multilateral level, I think it hasn't always helped. I think the controls of the Western suppliers in the 80s probably was a large part of why Iraq looked to its dual-use components. They didn't think of using older technology, which was what Iraq did in the 90s. They were looking at things that weren't necessarily controlled or had much attention paid to them because they'd been replaced by something new. So we're looking at a regime that has been in the past not very flexible and not very forward-thinking, but I think the regime can work. I think there are avenues yet to be explored. I think some of the work the IAEA is doing in its state-level approach to safeguards and the way that both the NSG and the ZANGA through the NPT are moving closer what we would ideally like to see is something that replaces all these separate fragmented regimes, which I think will be politically very difficult, though not necessarily impossible. But what is happening is the overlap is now enormous. The trigger lists are harmonized on the special and specific material. ZANGA can't cover dual use, but the NSG does. So as long as you've got both, you've got your special material covered, you've got dual use material covered. They both require safeguards. So as long as the IAE safeguards are up to scratch, then you've got that aspect of it covered. If the IAEA safeguards continue to improve, continue to expand the additional protocol, which allows the IAEA to assure the completeness as well as the correctness of a state's declared nuclear facilities, which is quite a delicate political balance up until that point, the IAEA, there were arguments over whether they had the right to go and look to see if a state's declaration was complete, as in had they declared everything. So the additional protocol is there to clarify that, yes, absolutely, it's not just what you've declared is correct, it's that it's also complete, you've declared everything. If that could be a condition of supply, you found a way to strengthen the regime in a way that is internationally recognizable. With safeguards, they're attempting to be less onerous through the state-level approach, so you've got ways of minimizing impact. So I do see a hope for a regime that will continue to be able to support industry without strangulating it, and that will also continue to have increased confidence in what states are doing.
Thank you. Final thoughts?
Yep. So I guess when thinking about whether export, they're good size and bad size, obviously they're both. But if I was to try and summarise what export controls are there to do, it's three Ds. Firstly, to deny the technology, which is kind of the obvious one, but also to detect so that intelligence services and governments around the world know what's going where and know what different states are up to. But also, I think that there's a kind of a deterrence value in there as well. And we discussed this earlier in the session about nuclear security. If you know that it's going to take twice or three times as long to do something, then maybe you're likely to put your effort elsewhere. But in terms of export controls more generally, I'd say concluding that they only really go so far. Obviously, there are non-controlled things which can be of use, and there are things that shouldn't be controlled. And this comes back to the sort of striking a balance and the reform and the higher fences in the smaller backyard. But I think a lot of this comes down to, as Isabel was saying, politics and the different regimes, both in terms of who a country decides to supply or to not supply, and what goods that they supply. And that's more of an international one that Isabel discussed. I think for industry, though, the crucial thing is obviously compliance is important, but also just to kind of carry out a lot of due diligence as much as you can, and also just to understand the risks more broadly. And hopefully we're going to try and help industry to do that. We've been trying for the past couple of years, and we've got this just been funded for this year as well. And perhaps there's something in the future too. So, yeah, thanks.
All right, well, thank you very, very much. Can we just have a round of applause for an extraordinary panel?